This is the place where I say, as usual, turn with me, if you will, to where this week's Torah portion begins. And it's right at the beginning of chapter 21 of the book of Exodus, or Shemot is the Hebrew word there. And it says, and these are ha-mishpatim. So the Torah portion, of course, is named for the first unique word, ha-mishpatim, or just mishpatim, actually. The ordinances, or the judgments, or the mishpatim, which you shall set before them. This is Yod-Heh, Vav-Heh speaking to Moshe. And notice a couple of things before we get rolling on this one. We have just finished with the Ten Commandments. And when the Ten Commandments were over, there is essentially one other thing that Yahuwah emphasizes again. You're not to make any pagan kind of things, not any fake gods out of gold or silver. Or don't. And when you do make an altar, make it out of earth to sacrifice your burnt offerings, your peace offerings, your sheep, in the place where I cause my name to be mentioned. Don't use hewn stones to do it. And then right after that, literally, we get these explanations, these ordinances, these judgments, and they follow immediately after the Ten Commandments. So a lot of folks say, oh, the Ten Commandments is it. But ultimately, no, there's a whole lot more. And it's these elucidations, these instructions that really flesh things out. And, of course, very important. So I want to make sure we emphasize that up front. Along with one other interesting thing, and that is, I've seen quite a bit of midrash on this of late. There are those that will say, oh, well, a lot of the stuff in here is fairly obvious. In other words, these are the kind of things that men could have come up with because, in a lot of cases, they're logical and so forth. Other scholars have pointed out, no, you can go to Roman society, you can go to Greek society, you can go to other predominant world cultures throughout history, and it ain't so obvious. There's a lot of stuff in here that is, in fact, very different than what those cultures ended up with. And I'll say it, these are better because these come from the Creator, and that's really the point. And it's also interesting, some of the order that is in here, because I like to put it this way. Right after he tells us, remember, five commandments more or less that have to do with our relationship to the Creator, five commandments that have to do with the relationship that we are to have one to another, or mankind with other men, or with society, call it what you want. Then we get this. So it's almost like he starts by saying, here are 10 things that will help you who have just come out of bondage to remain free, to live free. And then we get the converse right off the top. How about if you, still can't quite wrap your head around freedom? So it starts like this. If you buy a Hebrew servant, and it's Eved, 6 years he shall serve. 7th year he goes out free. In other words, he didn't have to pay anything. So isn't it funny? After just getting the rules for living free, we're going to get a reminder about bond service. Now, I'm going to make this distinction. What we're going to see here is that the rules that are being laid out for a Hebrew servant are, in fact, different than the mistreatment that they endured at the hands of Egypt, or indeed that most slaves throughout history have endured. So there is a difference between what's being described here, a bond service kind of an understanding, than just plain old base human slavery. As we go through this, you'll see it. But it's also interesting to note that if we compare modern society, and I'll probably do some of this tomorrow in more detail, you'll find that, there's a lot of things that are going on in America today and most of the Western world today, certainly in the communist world today, that are a whole lot worse than even these slave statutes. You buy a Hebrew servant, 6 years he shall serve, 7th year he goes out for free. Well, ask the IRS if after 6 years of serving as a slave to them, you can go out free in the 7th year. There's just an example. If he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he's married, he can take his wife with him. Now, you'll notice, if you compare the statutes and marriage licenses, this one, people don't like to think about it, but it applies. Because it says, if his master gives him a wife, she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children belong to the master. When he gets released, he goes out by himself. Ask yourself what the situation is with bond service to the Almighty State in terms of matrimony by license. Answer, the progeny are the states. If the dissolution of the licensed marriage happens, guess who owns who? It's not pleasant to think about, but it's hard to deny the obvious truth of that. If the servant then says, I really love my master and my wife and my children, I don't want to go out free. Well, then his master will bring him before Yahuwah. He brings him to the door, under the doorpost, and his master there will bore his ear through with an awl. So he literally puts an earring in the slave. And yeah, if you want to know where the custom comes from, there are a lot of people, including yours truly, that would suggest study the history. Sure looks like what we're seeing here are carryovers, particularly among males. Single earring, demonstrating this kind of bond service. He's a slave forever. If a man then sells his daughter to be a maidservant, she does not go out, she doesn't leave service as the men folk do. Now, right here, we're going to introduce one other concept, and this is what I would call the politically incorrect concept of bond service. The same people that want to deny that there is modern slavery going on, because we'll ignore the clear elements of this that are in place already, will say, oh, it's just not right that a man would sell his daughter to be a maidservant. And yet, the truth of the matter is, one of the reasons why these things were put in place was because not only was it common, and indeed it's still common in much of the world, and whether people like to admit it or not, for a whole lot of ways it's a lot more subtle. Yeah, it still goes on in the U.S. and in Canada and in Britain and all those places too. This is a protection for women. And the idea is that when a man couldn't offer his daughter something, in other words, he was poor, she didn't have much going for her from the family standpoint, and the idea was, well, maybe if I sell her to somebody to be a maidservant, he can provide her a better life. And particularly knowing that there were these protections in place, like the next one. If she doesn't please her master, the one who has espoused her to himself, then he is to let her be redeemed. He does not have the power. He is not allowed to sell her to a foreign people because he is the one that's dealt deceitfully with her. If he espouses her instead to his son, well, then she is like a daughter. He is to deal with her after the manner of daughters. So here are some pretty clear protections. Verse 10 in Exodus chapter 21 is one of the more politically incorrect verses, and there are a number in this portion. It says essentially that a man may take more than one wife. If he takes another wife, then her food, her clothing, and her conjugal rights, the duties of marriage is how sometimes it's translated into the English. But conjugal rights, well, we understand what this is. This is essentially saying the man has an obligation to provide sexually and in a spiritual sense and in all of the things that are associated with covering and marriage. He is to do those for his wife. And if he's going to take another wife, he has to be able to do it for all of them. If he does not do those things for her, then she does not owe him the price that was paid for. She is to go out free without money. Again, this is another level of protection. Now, there's one more comment that I should make on this, and that, of course, is if you see a standard Hebrew or modern-day Jewish rabbinic ketubah, a marriage contract, it will almost always include the references there in verse 10, that the husband promises to do those three things for the wife, food, clothing, and duties of marriage as part of the deal. And the logic goes something like this, and this is actually one of those cases where I think there's a pretty good case to be made. If this is the way it's supposed to be for a bond servant wife, well, then the heavy and the light, how much more so for any wife? So that is generally taken to be kind of the minimum necessary conditions that if a man can't provide those things, he's probably got no business taking a wife to begin with. Part of the reasons why we see a lot of other traditional things happening, because there needs to be a certain level of maturity and capability. All right, I'm going to change gears at this point. If a person smites someone, a man, so that he dies, he is in fact deserving of death. So for slaying, there is the death penalty. Now, we've already seen this. We are now seeing another element of this additional fleshing out. The Ten Commandments, if you will, just simply says, lo tirtzak, no murdering, don't do it. And here we're told, if you do, there's a death penalty for that. How about if a man does not lie in wait, but Elohim causes it to come to hand? Huh? What? In other words, there is a difference between slaying somebody which would imply lying in wait or looking for an opportunity, and something that simply happens by the insurance companies call an act of God, an accident. Couldn't have expected that, but it happened anyway. Oh, well, then, says Yahuwah, I will appoint a place that he can flee to. If a man comes presumptuously upon his neighbor, and the intent is to slay him with guile, take him from my altar so that he might die. Hunting people, not permitted. How about fathers and mothers? If he smites his father or his mother, that too is deserving of death. He that steals a man and sells him, steals a man, and this, by the way, is a really similar world. Gonav, a man, sells him. If the man is found in his hand, in other words, if you have witnesses and you've actually caught him in the act, then he is to be put to death. So kidnapping also carries a death penalty. He that curses father or mother, also put to death. So it's not just slaying or smiting father or mother, cursing them is worthy of a death penalty. If men contend, and one smites the other with a stone or with his fist, he doesn't die, but he is bedridden for a while. If he ever gets up and he walks around on his staff, then the one that smote him is off the hook, basically. He is to pay, however, he is to reimburse that person for the loss of his time and for medical expenses. Basically, he's to cause him to be thoroughly healed. If a man smites his bondman or his bondwoman with a rod and they die, he is deserving of punishment. Notwithstanding, if the bondservant persists for a while, he is not to be punished for that. If men strive together and they hurt a woman who is pregnant so that she loses the child, but yet no additional harm follows, that man is to be fined, and it is according to what the woman's husband will lay upon him and as the judges determine. If any other harm follows, though, here comes the famous verse, you are to give life for life, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. But what's interesting here, and I usually make this point, what's translated as eye for an eye, eye is ayin, right? Ayin tachat ayin. Eye for an eye. But wait a minute, that's not really quite right. Tachat doesn't just mean for, it literally means in place of, in substitutionary replacement of. How do we understand that? I'm going to suggest it this way. What's being described here is measure for measure. In other words, what is of equal weight? How do you reimburse somebody for the loss of an eye? Well, that's a tough call, right? How do you reimburse somebody for the loss of a tooth or a hand or a foot? That's tough. But there is at least an implication of this ayin tachat ayin in place of, equivalent to, that kind of makes it easier to understand. And I like to put it this way, right? What's your eye worth to you? You did something very negligent, wrong, cost somebody their eye. This verse is not saying, and as a matter of fact, this has never been done, as far as I can tell from looking out, at least not officially by the Sanhedrin or by any other elements of law throughout history in Israel. But it certainly makes the sense of the monetary value. In other words, what's your eye worth to you? How much would you pay if the alternative was to lose your eye? At least as a thought experiment, right? Well, my eye's worth quite a bit to me. I might be willing to work really hard to keep my eye. Well, then, isn't that exactly what you owe to the person whose eye you took through your negligence, your carelessness, your act of wanton disregard for their eye or whatever the case may have been? It puts it in a lot more perspective. In place of is a far better understanding. And if you look at other uses in Scripture, like back in Bereshit 4, where you see Seth in place of Abel, then it makes sense. Also, at the binding of Isaac, you have a ram, tachat, the son. So it was a ram in place of Isaac. So in those cases, it really does make sense. And of course, when it comes to this whole concept of redemption, it applies as well. It's in place of. All right, if a man smites the eye of a bondman or a bondwoman and puts that eye out, That person gets to go free for the sake of the eye. Same thing for a tooth. They get to go free. If an ox, now this is a little bit of a change here. Now we're going to talk about essentially what would be called a negligence and culpability. There are a whole lot of elements of this portion as we go through them here that are going to be literally right at the base, at the root of what was once called British common law, English common law, and by reference in the Constitution, back when we had a Constitution, it was incorporated into the Constitution too. And it became the basis for American common law. So if an ox gores somebody, man or woman, and they die, well, the ox basically is a dangerous animal. It's to be stoned. And its flesh is not even to be eaten. The owner of the ox, however, is off the hook. Well, in general, but wait just a minute. He gets one free pass is the way it works here. If the ox, however, has been known to gore in times past, then it's a whole different story. What we now have is negligence. The owner knew, should have taken better precautions. This was a dangerous ox. Warning has been given to the owner, furthermore. He did not keep the ox in. Now it's killed a man or a woman. That ox is to be stoned. Yeah, it's still worthy of death. And its owner, too, having literally committed negligent homicide, shall be put to death. Now, here is a place where he can be tekhat. If there's on him laid a ransom, then he can give for the redemption of his life whatever is laid upon him. Now, think about this for a second. This is a great understanding as well. This basically says you, Mr. Negligent guy, have cost someone's life to be forfeit or, done something heinous. On the other hand, putting you to death does not make that family whole again. What would you pay in order to live? What's your life worth to you? Pay the price. And here is here's another element, in other words, of making the people who were damaged by the negligence whole. Whether it's gored a son or a daughter, according to this judgment, that is to be done to him. If the ox gores a bond man or a bond woman, then he gives to the master 30 shekels of silver. Still, though, the ox is forfeit. If a man opens a pit, digs a pit, doesn't cover it. So here's another act of negligence. You got this pit, you dig it, you don't take proper precautions, and an ox or an ass falls into it. The owner of the pit is to make that good. He is to pay the owner of the dead beast. Now, the dead beast then belongs to the one that paid for it. Makes sense. If a man's ox hurts another man's ox so that it dies, then what do you do? Well, this is a nice understanding too. It's a clever way of reconciling. They sell the live ox, and then they divide the price of it, and then they divide the dead ox as well. So essentially, everybody's out an ox, but they do get the meat and they do get the money, at least part of both. If it's known that the ox, however, was wont to gore in times past, the owner hasn't kept in, well, now he's to pay ox for ox. The dead beast is his own. He's out of luck. If a man steals something, an animal, an ox or a sheep, he kills it or sells it, he is to pay a lot more than what he stole. This is not only restitution, but restitution with a penalty. For an ox, he pays 5 oxen, and 4 sheep for a sheep. In verse 22, going to change gears just a little bit more. Let's talk about breaking and entering. A man's home is his castle is one way of kind of summarizing some of the elements of this. But the onus of the thief is that he ought to be really careful. Shouldn't be doing this to begin with. And if he does, if the thief is found breaking in, says chapter 22 off the top, and he's smitten so that he dies, the English translation says this, there shall be no blood guilt for him. In other words, the person who kills this guy that's broken into their house is justified. Now, I like the Rashi literal transmission, it literally says he has no blood. He has no dam. In other words, and this is a line from Star Trek, if I remember right, he's dead already. The moment somebody in a thief mode crosses the threshold, he's dead already. If he is killed as a result of that act of breaking and entering, the person who's in their own home is entirely justified. He has no blood. If the sun has risen upon him, though, there's a blood guiltiness for him. He makes restitution. If he has nothing, he then becomes a bond servant. He's sold into bondage for his theft. So essentially, the idea here is catch him in the act is one thing, but if he gets away and he's out, well, he has blood again, and now to go out and kill him is an act of retribution. He is to make restitution or be sold into bondage, but not dead. Thief is found with the ox or ass or whatever, sheep in his hand and still alive, he pays double. So he pays double and it would seem like the person gets their sheep back to boot. If a man causes a field or vineyard to be eaten, he lets his beast loose, right? Let's go out and let our animals graze in somebody else's field. He is to make restitution. He feeds the best of his own field, the best of his own vineyard is the way that he is to make restitution for the loss. Again, very reasonable, very, I would say, wise understandings. And that's part of the reason these are the basis for the common law. It makes sense, and it also makes for a society where there is a not just punishment, right? Putting somebody in jail, folks, does nothing. Jail, indeed, is not a Torah-based prison or a Torah-based remedy at all. People are only put in a ward, basically, while they're waiting to find out what's going to be done with them in rare cases. And nobody is improved. There's no restitution made, right? The people versus so-and-so. No, the people get nothing, basically. They pay for these people to be incarcerated. This Torah-based understanding is a far better way to make society run and to prevent the kind of proliferation of crime that we have nowadays. Imagine if thieves had to pay back double or be sold into bondage. Man causes the vineyard, okay, he offers the best of his own. If a fire breaks out and catches in the thorns and it literally it burns someone's standing corn, consumes their field, the person that kindles the fire, what, is liable. He makes restitution. If a man delivers his neighbor money or anything like that, stuff to keep. This is called a bailment in common law. In other words, you say, oh, here, will you take care of my animal? Will you take care of my car? Take care of this property while I'm out of town or whatever the case. All right, then there are some understandings. If it's stolen from the man's house, same thing applies. The thief pays double. Suppose, though, that the thief is not found. Hey, you know, you left me all that stuff and it got stolen. Oh, really? Sorry about that. Sorry, you're out of luck. Nope. That's not the way it works. If the thief isn't found, the master of the house is to come before Yahuwah. Now, nowadays, with Congress and with most of the scumbags in the various three-letter agencies that routinely put their hand on a Bible and lie, this doesn't work for obvious reasons, because they'll lie just like they would here. But in this case, the idea is that these people actually fear Yah, and when somebody makes an oath before him, they understand that it's important. So the master of the house comes near unto Yah to see whether or not he's put his hand into his neighbor's goods. Did you steal the stuff or not? For every matter of trespass, it says, whether it's for an ox or an ass or sheep or clothing or anything that's lost, and someone says, this is it, well, the cause of both parties shall come before Elohim, and the one that Elohim condemns shall pay double unto his neighbor. Now, back to the bailments. If a man delivers to his neighbor an ox or an ass or a sheep or a beast to keep it, and it dies or it's hurt or it's driven away, no one sees it, then, again, we're going to have an oath before Yahuwah between them. See whether or not he's put his hand into his neighbor's goods. And the owner is to accept that oath. He does not make restitution. It was theft. It was loss. It was unavoidable. And, they're willing to stand before the Creator. Imagine if a man's word was his bond. It used to be we had that. We had people of honor. We've come a long ways, and it's not been good. If it's stolen from him, he makes restitution. If it's torn in pieces, we've already seen this in Genesis, well, then there's a relatively straightforward way to make a proof. Let him bring the pieces for a witness, the flesh, the hide of the animal. He does not make good that which was torn. So he's got the proof, and the owner accepts that. If a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it's hurt or it dies and the owner's not there, he is to make restitution. So you borrow something, you break it, you make restitution. If the owner is with it He doesn't make it good. If it's a hireling, he loses his hire. So if we're both using the tools and they break, it was my tool and it broke while we were both using it. All right. On the other hand, if it's somebody that's hired that's using the tool, he doesn't get paid for the job. How about on to a little bit more of marriage-related items? Here's another politically incorrect verse. If a man entices a virgin, a betula, someone who is not betrothed, and this is the first use we see of that word here, she does not, in other words, she's not under contract for marriage, and he lies with her, she's not under contract for marriage. She is a virgin. She could be somebody's wife. Well, guess what? She is. He pays the dowry for her to be his wife. So a man takes a virgin. She's not under contract to some other man. He now has a wife. Now, there is an exception here, and this is kind of interesting. The father of the bride, we're going to see this in Numbers chapter 30, the father does have veto power. This is a virgin living in his house. He can evaluate the man here and decide whether this is a good match for his daughter or not. If the father utterly refuses to give her to him, well, then he pays money according to the dowry of virgins. He's still paying for her, but he doesn't get to keep her. The father has veto power over a marriage that he doesn't think is good for the daughter. Verse 17 is also politically incorrect, and I'm going to say it. If we had this verse in effect, there would be a heck of a lot less criminally illegal, evil, traitorous, scumbag, anti-God people in Congress and running for president and doing all kinds of stuff. Thou shalt not suffer a sorceress to live. First use, Exodus chapter 7. Kasafa. Whoever lies with a beast is deserving of death. This is bestiality, not permitted. And, of course, as we move through the Torah in the United States and basically take everything and turn it upside down, I'm not kidding, folks. I fully expect to see that'll be next on the Supreme Court's agenda. We've got all this other perversion that we're licensing and mandating and supporting and subsidizing. Why not bestiality? Anybody want to bet? We're getting real close. If it carries a death penalty especially, they're more than anxious to try to do it because that seems to be the goal. He that sacrifices to fake gods, save only unto Yahuwah, shall be utterly destroyed. Now, what's interesting in some of these cases here, there is an indication that something is deserving of death or utter destruction. But in this case, for example, it doesn't tell us how that's to happen. I tend to think that the implication is these things may carry a death penalty. And, when it comes to, for example, a man lying with a man as with a woman, we can see that there are all kinds of medical and other ways that life expectancy is dramatically reduced. These things come to pass. A stranger you shall not wrong, nor shall you oppress him. You too were strangers in the land of Mizraim. Don't afflict a widow or fatherless child. If you do, and they cry out to me, I'm going to hear their cry, and you are in a heap of trouble. My wrath shall wax hot. I will kill you with the sword, Becherev, and your wives shall be widows, your children fatherless. That's a serious threat. Again, right from the Creator. Do not afflict widows and fatherless children, because I will wax hot against you, kill you with the sword, and your wives will be widows, your children fatherless. If you lend money to any of my people, to the poor within you, don't be like a creditor. Don't lay interest upon him. Usury is often how that's rendered. But if you take your neighbor's garment to pledge, give it to him before the sun goes down. Give it back. This is what he's got, okay? It's his covering. Oh, where's he going to sleep? It'll come to pass when he cries out to me. I'll hear. I'm gracious. Do not revile Elohim, nor curse a ruler of your people. Don't delay to offer the fullness of your harvest, the outflow of your presses, your firstborn, those you give unto me. We're going to see that they can be redeemed, of course. That's part of the tachat point, redeem them for another item of value. Likewise, you do with your oxen, with your sheep. 7 days it stays with its mother. 8th day you give it to me. You shall be holy men set apart unto me. Therefore, you don't eat anything. I call this the roadkill prohibition. Don't eat any flesh that is torn of beasts in the field. That is for the dogs. Chapter 23 is essentially another one of these that is very politically incorrect. Well, maybe not. They don't talk about it. They just plain do it. I look at Congress. I look at, a man's word isn't worth squat anymore. People are taught that, it's okay, to lie if you have King's X or stuff. If you accept the favored religion of Allah, well, and then it's okay to lie. That's not what Scripture says. It says, you shall not utter a false report, nor do you put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. Now, we're going to see several items in this list here that are going to kind of make that point. But I like a summary that I remember reading years ago. Essentially, distance yourself from falsehood. All of these things are a problem. People of Yah are simply not to be associated with false reports, unrighteous witnesses going with the wicked. Verse 2 really nails it. You shall not follow a multitude to do evil. Now, full stop. Wait a minute. Don't we live in a democracy? Well, actually, if you read the Constitution, no, never have. Hopefully, prayerfully, we never will. Because what is a democracy? It's following a multitude to do evil. What are we told? Well, if the majority vote to steal stuff, it's okay. The majority vote to kill, it's okay. There is no majority vote to override the commandments of Yah. Do not follow a multitude to do evil. It's called mobocracy, in other words. Nor shall you bear witness in a cause to turn aside after a multitude to pervert justice. Oh, everybody else was doing it, so I'll lie along with them. We can all pile on and steal. Folks, this is socialism. This is communism. This is fascism. This is just about every ism you can think of, except for those that follow the Creator. And we've come so far from it. Nor shall you favor a poor man in his cause. What? If he claims to be poor, doesn't he get to violate all the rules about illegal immigration? And doesn't he get to get away with murder? And can't he steal from people and follow after a multitude to do nasty stuff? If a bunch of people come across the border, there are all kinds of things that we now excuse that are just plain simply forbidden for obvious reasons. At least they were once obvious reasons. And they're right here in genuine print. If you see your enemy's ox or his ass going astray. So here's a person you're not wild about. You don't like him, but some animal of theirs is going in the wrong direction. What are you supposed to do? Well, finders, keepers, losers, weepers, shoot it, leap. No. If you find the enemy's ox or his ass going astray, you bring it back to him. How about if you see the ass of him that hates you? And it's struggling under its burden. You do not pass by. You release it with him. Whoa, you're supposed to help even your enemy or his animals when they're in trouble. Yep. You do not rest the judgment of the poor in his cause. This is precisely the opposite of what we see in California. Right? We got all these people coming in. Oh, they get to come in, they get to steal. Oh, they get to do things that real Americans aren't allowed to do. They get to pervert justice. We're going to give them special. That's wrong. You shall not rest the judgment of the poor in his cause. Summarizing some of these, keep yourself far from a false matter. Yep, distance yourself from falsehood, deception, vanity. That's the lie that's listed in here. And it literally just means, the word is debar, right? A thing. Stay far away from a false thing. The innocent and the righteous you do not slay. Because I will not justify the wicked, says Yahuwah. Don't take a bribe, for a bribe or a gift blinds those that have sight, perverts the words of the righteous. We got so many examples of that in what now passes for a bogus court system. It boggles the mind. A stranger shall you not oppress, because you know the heart of a stranger. You were one, right? Back in the land of Mitzrayim. And it's actually, for you know, it says the heart of the stranger in here, but the Hebrew word in there is literally the soul, the nefesh. Not the lev, but the soul, the life of a stranger, because you were one. 6 years you sow your land, you gather in the increase. 7th year you let the land rest, so that the poor of your people can eat, and when they leave the beast of the field shall eat too. In like manner, that's how you deal with your vineyard and your olive yard. So there is a time to sow, a time to reap, and a time to let things lie fallow. 6 years. Likewise, right after that, 6 days, it says, do your work. 7th day, you rest. Same thing goes for your ox and your ass. They get to rest too. And the sons of your handmaid and the stranger, all of them, they get this day of rest. In all things that I've said to you, take heed. Make no mention of the name of other fake gods. Now, I'm putting that word fake in there, as you know. Other Elohim. They're not real gods. They're just mighty ones in the Hebrew, Elohim. The difference is, of course, there is one true Elohim, and then there's others that aren't. And you don't see the capitalization in the Hebrew, so it's by context that this becomes clear. Don't even let the other names of those other fake gods be heard out of your mouth. Then we're going to see some references to the so-called Feasts of Ascension. We know basically what those are, but we're going to get an outline here. Three times a year, keep a feast unto me. And that word there is a chag, a feast. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, the one that's coming up next, keep. 7 days you eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you, in the appointed time in the month of Aviv. That's the month you came up out of Egypt. And no one shall appear before me empty-handed. In the Feast of the Harvest, the first fruits of your labors when you sow the field, the Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year when you gather your laborers out of the field, three times in the year all males shall appear before Yahuwah. Don't sacrifice or offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread. Neither shall the fat of my feast remain all night until morning. These are commandments that we've heard, but they're being repeated here. The choicest first fruits of your land you bring into the house of Yahuwah, do not seethe a kid in its mother's milk. All right, full stop. That one's kind of interesting. It just kind of appears. It's like the second half. It's verse 19b. Talking about first fruits, bring those into the house of Yahuwah. Then it says, do not seethe the kid in its mother's milk. What the heck does that mean? Now this, just for purposes of completeness, is the rabbinic verse that is usually cited for the milk and meat mixing thing when it comes to rabbinic kosher. They will say, this is the verse, in other words, it says you can't mix meat and milk. So you have to have a separate refrigerator, separate dishes, and all that kind of stuff. Quite honestly, folks, I know this is where they get it. I don't buy it. It just plain doesn't ring true with me. As near as I can tell, there was, in fact, a pagan tradition of doing this for some reason, and it references a practice that is in line with this idea of doing things that other gods had their people do that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh doesn't want anything to do with. But there you go. So, you know, don't do it, obviously. And as to whether or not this says you can't mix milk and meat, don't have a cheeseburger, I've heard it. I won't say I don't understand it. I don't think that that's a decent reading of it, honestly. But your mileage may vary. I'm certainly not going to say to somebody that says, I don't want to do it and I'm not going to eat a cheeseburger, great. I have no problem with that. If you read it that way, more power to you. And then by all means, follow your convictions. But when I read it, that says to me, don't see the kid in its mother's milk. Behold, he continues, I send a malach. What's a malach? Well, it gets translated as angel, but it's really a messenger. I send a messenger before you to keep you by the way, to bring you to the place that I prepared. Take heed of this messenger. Hearken to his voice. Don't rebel against him. He's not going to pardon your transgression, for my name is in him. My name is in him. Yahushua, my name is in him. Okay. I can certainly see elements that might be read to suggest what that messenger, who that messenger is and what is being understood there. But I suspect there's even more to it than that. Obviously, though, if you hearken indeed to his voice and do all that I speak, I will be an enemy unto your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. Now, throughout history, I think there's a pretty good case to be made, and I certainly understand that the rabbinic Judaism would make the case that there have been at least one, maybe more, of these messengers that have come before. So I don't have a problem, as you know, with the idea of multiple fulfillments or the fact that he can use lots of messengers. For my messenger shall go before you, bring you in unto the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Canaanite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. I'm going to cut all of them off. Don't bow down to their gods. Don't serve them. Don't do anything that they do. If you do, you shall utterly overthrow them. And you are to break in peace. The root word there in the Hebrew gets translated as harass. Harass their fake gods. Over and over in the Torah, we're going to see this. When you get into the land, you're going to not just tear down their things. You're going to burn them. You're going to slash them. You're going to dash them. You're going to tear them in pieces. These are words, often verbs in the Peel conjugation. They're action verbs. He despises these fake gods. And we're seeing in this section too, chapter 23, any number of ways of making that crystal clear. You shall serve Yahuwah your El. He will bless your bread and your water. I'll take sickness away from the midst of you. No one will miscarry nor be barren in the land. And the number of days I will fulfill. I will send my terror before you. You'll discomfort all the people upon whom you shall come. And I'll make your enemies turn their backs to you. Now, they'll turn their backs and they'll run. I'll send the hornet before you too. And that'll drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, the Hittite from before you. I won't drive them out though too fast, he says. I'm not going to do it in just 1 year. Lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field multiply against you. So you're going to displace them over a period of time. Little by little, I'm going to drive them out from before you till you're increased. And then you can inherit the land. And I'll set your border from the Red Sea, the Sea of Reeds, even to the Sea of the Philistines, Mediterranean, from the wilderness unto the river. I'll deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand. You'll drive them out before you. Now, here comes one of the really important commandments. And if you go to look at the book of Joshua, you'll see Joshua blew this one. You shall make no covenant, no brit, with the inhabitants of the land, nor with their so-called Elohim. They shall not dwell in the land. Because if you do, they will make you sin against me. You'll end up serving their gods. That will be a snare to you. So be careful. And as we see, indeed, they did make those treaties. And he was right. They were a snare, and they eventually ended up, of course, as we know, and here we still are in exile. Chapter 24 is a summary now. By the way, having gone through all of those, I'll point out one other thing. Mishpatim, which has to do with ordinances or judgments, is the most Mishpatim-laden parsha in the whole Torah. Got the number here. 53 different Mishpatim in this one Torah portion. So that's the mostest Mishpatim in the book, in a portion. So here we have Moshe. He goes and he's told, come to Yahuwah. Bring Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, the 70 elders of Israel, and worship far off. Moshe will come near unto Yahuwah, but they don't come near, nor shall people go up with him. So Moshe is fixing to go up the mountain. That's how this portion is going to end. Moses came. He told the people all the words of Yahuwah, all the ordinances. And all of the people answered, what? With kol echad, one voice, a unified answer. And they said the following. Now this is important, and it's going to be repeated here. All of the words which Yahuwah has spoken, we will do. I say, do. Moshe wrote the words of Yahuwah. He got up early in the morning. He built an altar, 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel, sent the young men of the children of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto Yahuwah. Moshe then took half of the blood of these offerings, put it in basins, half of the blood he dashed against the altar. He took the book of the covenant, the sefer that he had written, and he read in the hearing of the people, and they said again, all that Yahuwah has spoken, we will do and obey. Now, this one is an interesting too. It's not asay ve nishma. Nishma. Okay, the N prefix there is kind of like the future tense for what? The word shema or shamar, hear and obey. So, they say, basically, all that Yahuwah has spoken, we're going to do, we're going to asay, and we are going to shema as well. Hear and obey. And in this case, you'll see some of the sages say, hey, there does sound like there's both overlap here and some redundancy, in other words, but something else is being added. And at least a couple of the sages suggest maybe the broader, understanding is they will do, and in so doing, they will not only be obeying and hearing, but they will understand. So I think that's an interesting way to look at it. This is quite the response. All that Yahuwah has spoken, all the words He's spoken, we will do and obey. So Moshe took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and he said, "Behold, this is the dam, the blood of the brit, which Yahuwah has made with you in agreement with all these words." So Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, 70 elders of Israel, they saw the Elohim of Israel. There was under his feet a like paved work of sapphire stone, like the very heavens for clearness. Upon the nobles of the children of Israel, he did not lay his hand. They beheld Elohim, they ate and they drank. And Yahuwah said to Moshe, "Come on up to me in the mountain, be there, and I will give you tablets of stone, which will contain the Torah and the commandment, which I've written, that you may teach them." So Moshe got up, and along with him, Yahshua, his minister, Moshe went up to the Har Ha-Elohim, the mountain of El. To the elders he said that, "Y'all stay here till we come back to you. Behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Anybody has a problem, have something they need, you guys go to them. Bring your cause to them." So Moshe went up the mount, and the cloud covered the mount, and the glory of Yahuwah abode upon Mount Sinai. The cloud covered it 6 days. On the seventh day, he called unto Moshe from out of the cloud. And the appearance of the glory of Yahuwah was like a devouring fire up on top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. Moshe entered the midst of the cloud. He went up in the mountain. And here's where the portion ends. Interestingly, we're going to see that there is the plot thickening here as Moshe goes into the thick cloud as well. Because some of us, most of us probably, know what happens after this. Moshe goes up into the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. And with that, the Torah portion ends.